Welcome to Piano Fortissimo, the podcast where the world of classical music meets personal stories and professional insights. I'm your host, Alexandra Silocha, concert pianist and bossa nova artist for over two decades. Join me as we explore the intricacies of music careers, the artistry behind pianos and other instruments, dive deep with special guests from all corners of the arts, and uncover the nuances of cultural and self-management. Whether you're an aspiring musician, a performer, or simply a music lover, this podcast offers something for everyone. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Piano Fortissimo podcast, episode 16. It feels like it's been a huge break, and, well, it actually was. But the truth is, I've been busy, really, really busy, performing, teaching, traveling. So thank you so much for your patience and for still being here and tuning in again. I've missed these conversations, and I'm truly excited about what's coming next, and I promise it's worth the wait. Today on the Piano Fortissimo podcast, I'm joined by a truly unique voice in the world of classical music, Hyun-Ki Ju. British pianist, composer, and educator of Korean heritage, renowned for his expressive playing, magnetic stage presence, and unconventional approach to music making. A graduate of the Yehudi Menuhin School and the Manhattan School of Music, where he was the latter awarded an honorary doctorate, Hyun-Ki has performed with major orchestras such as the London Philharmonic, the Santa Cecilia Orchestra in Rome, and the Seoul Philharmonic. As a chamber musician, he's collaborated with legendary names including Julia Fischer, Janin Jensen, Gidon Kremer, and Victoria Mulova, and he has a special love for vocal repertoire, working with artists like Dame Felicity Lott, Priti Yende, and Asmik Grigorian. Beyond the stage, Hyun-Ki is artistic director of the Menuhin Competition and Piano City Vienna. He's also a passionate teacher mentoring young musicians at top institutions around the world. His compositions have been commissioned by the New York Philharmonic and the Vienna Symphony, among others. And of course, for over two decades, he's brought joy to global audiences as one half of Igudes Man and Ju, blending classical music, comedy, and pop culture, a duo that will take their final bow in 2025. From recording Billy Joel's classical album to curating the Vienna Festwochen opening, Hyun-Ki's artistic reach seems limitless. I'm thrilled to welcome him today to explore the many sides of creativity, risk, and reinvention in classical music. Hyun-Ki Ju, I'm delighted to have you today in my living room in Vienna.
Molsumesk, thank you so much.
I have the feeling we have so much to talk. There are so many themes I'd like to discuss, so let's start straight away.
Sure.
You're known for breaking barriers between classical music and humor. What inspired you to take this unique approach?
Well, the source of inspiration or necessity is really because when I was younger, when I was a kid, I used to go to concerts. I went to the Menuhin School at the age of 10, and I discovered that it's something I learned much later. It's called imposter syndrome. I didn't know what it was called then, but I really felt like an imposter because I arrived at the school with only 2 years of piano lessons, and my roommate was 2 years younger, and he was playing Rachmaninoff III, and my other roommate was writing an opera, and so I felt like, oh my God, and I'm just playing Bach, Prelude in C major. So I thought, okay, they're going to see that they made a mistake. And I remember coming out of piano lessons with a very demanding teacher. His name was Peter Norris, terrified and crying and feeling like I'm never good enough. But the one thing that kept me hoping that I would stay on at the school, and what gave me confidence that I believe I'm supposed to be there, was that I felt there's nobody in the world that loves classical music more than me. It's a feeling I have still today. And when I went to concerts a little bit later, I started to feel like the atmosphere here, the way it's performed, the way it's listened to, the way the audience was reacting, the way the performers walked on stage wearing black penguin suits, this whole ceremony, this whole elitism and very snobbish, stuffy, claustrophobic ambiance had very little, it was very disconnected to me from the music that I felt so passionate about. And I was sure that, of course, I never met these composers, but I was sure that there was so much life and humor, even though some of these composers had very difficult lives. But you feel that the music that they wrote with so much fun, so much essence of joy, and even if it's a requiem or whatever, there's this like passionate energy in it. And the room just felt devoid of all of that. Mm. It was like, let's clamp it down. And I felt like, ooh, I don't feel comfortable here. I would like to leave. And I was thinking, I'm the kid that loves classical music most in the world. And I want to leave this concert hall. We have a problem. Mm-hmm. And that was really the inspiration for me. I thought, well, when I'm older, or even in my days at Yehud Emanuel School, I want to try and find a way for music to be able to connect with not just connoisseurs, but exactly not the connoisseurs, mm-hmm. the people from the streets, the people who've never been into concert halls, the young people. One of the first concert experiences I ever had was playing for a school for deaf children. And I had very little performing experience. And I remember being in the van, going to this school for deaf children, and I heard that we're going to play for children who are deaf. And I thought, what? Mm-hmm. This doesn't make any sense at all. They're deaf. They cannot hear. So it's going to be a waste of time. And I didn't understand. And then I started playing, and a whole load of children rushed up on stage and started putting their head inside the piano and going under the piano and sitting very close to me and putting their heads almost on my laps. And I just thought, what is going on here? And then I looked out, and there were many of the kids were also like dancing and gesticulating in the hall. And I thought, wow, these guys are so, they're hearing it.
To open.
They're feeling it. Obviously, sound is vibration. Music is emotion, it's intention. So it goes beyond all the stuff that we're so concerned about the correct notes, the phrasing, whether it's urtext or not. This is all, yeah, it's important for us, but at the end of the day, it means it's the intention of the emotion. And I mean, obviously, these people cannot hear. They can hardly hear. Mm-hmm. So if they're reacting that strongly, it shows you how powerful music is. Mm-hmm. And this kind of power and this kind of joy, you almost never find in a classical concert hall. So this is what drove me to say, we have to somehow make concerts like this. It should have this impact. Mm-hmm. And we can hear. Most people who go to concert, we can hear. We should be having the same feeling. And luckily, when I was 12, I met this guy called Alexei Gulizman. And he shared, of course, similar ideals. And we were both composers. And we felt like, well, okay, maybe we cannot change the world, but at least in our compositions and when we do our own concerts, we will do it in a way that we would want to go to our own concerts. That's really the inspiration.
Cannot believe it's like a lifetime.
Yes, I have spent pretty much my lifetime trying to move this dinosaur. Yes.
Well, as you said, you achieved this because your performances with Gulizman have introduced countless people to classical music in an unexpected way. How did you balance humor with musical integrity?
Wow.
I mean, I've been to your concerts. I know the answer, but still, it's I think it's something interesting to hear.
I think for Alexei and I, individually and together as a duo, it was always about the music. It is about the music. The music always came first. And believe it or not, we never sat down and said, how can we be funny? How can we now make people laugh? That was never the creative process. It was, wow, isn't this an interesting parallel? Look, Mozart sounds like Rachmaninoff, which sounds like James Bond, which sounds like this. Or wouldn't it be funny if the... We had a wonderful composition teacher called Simon Parkin. And I definitely owe a lot of my... His influence definitely rubbed off on me. He's such a genius. And in composition lessons and improvisation lessons, he would just sit down and say, oh, this is how Greek piano concerto sounds like in the whole tone scale. Or this is how it sounds in the Phrygian scale. And introducing us to modes and different ways of hearing by parodying this stuff, which we, of course we thought was hilarious, but actually it opened us up to a whole other landscape of things. And it also showed us what is possible. And I think another thing is that there are so many composers in classical music who are actually very funny. There's a lot of humor in classical music. And actually, classical musicians don't take the humor in classical music seriously enough. So much Haydn, so much Mozart, so much Beethoven, Shostakovich, Snitkin, I mean, Schumann, there's so much stuff, Rossini. And it's always like, oh, you know. But these composers, when they wrote their so-called funny stuff, they didn't degrade their quality. They didn't belittle them. You know, Mozart, I don't know if I can say this on the podcast, but, you know, he wrote music about farting and pooping and other stuff, let's say, for the podcast's sake. But he didn't diminish his genius when he was writing his Requiem or his Don Giovanni or clarinet concerto. It's the same guy. It's the same composer. And even in those scatological pieces or whatever, it's the same musical invention. Same with Haydn. He doesn't go, oh, now I'm going to write a funny piece for the common people or put a joke in here, so therefore I don't care about the quality of the music. And that kind of was the same for Alexia and I. We said, okay, if we're building in some kind of joke, some kind of musical humor, it has to be of compositional interest, of musical integrity, and never making fun of music and musicians, but having fun with the music and having fun with this whole industry and elitist ceremony and just parodying it, satirizing it. We always try to avoid direct references. I remember one of my most favorite sketches that we did in the early days was a game show between John Cage and Pierre Boulez. And Boulez was still alive at the time. I mean, I don't think he ever saw it and didn't care. I mean, I doubt very much he saw it. But the point was, we wanted to do a sketch about contemporary music. And the idea was that Cage and Boulez have 1 minute to write a piece. And Cage is just throwing coins and bananas and dice. And Boulez is, you know, writing on a calculator and making all these formulas. We had a projector screen. You could see Boulez. You know. And at the end of this minute, we play these pieces next to each other. And of course, they sound exactly the same. The first few times we did that, and then I remember we reinvestigated it. We said, you know what? We should not make fun of Cage and Boulez. We should go one step further. So it was John Cake versus Pierre Bouillabaisse.
Genius.
Now, for those who know, they know it's a parody on the names. So many people who came to our concerts have no idea who is Pierre Boulez or John Cage. So it's irrelevant to mention their real names. No, but I'm just mentioning this because it's just a small example to show that we were never interested in political statements or firing particular, you know, pointing the fingers at this and this. We wanted to have fun with the whole thing.
Do you think classic musicians have less fun, or they're taking music too serious due to their education, or are we too stuck in this tradition of being serious in order to be taken serious?
I think a lot of classical musicians take themselves way too seriously, partly also not their fault, because the entourage, the ecosystem, even if you're a young wunderkind and not successful but clearly showing talent, loves to make this whole hysteria and hype that, oh my God, here is the new Mozart, and ooh, he shouldn't, you know, play sports, and it's, you know, we should protect his fingers. And I mean, my mother also was like not letting me do the washing up and stuff. I was like, no, it's for me, who can, you know. I mean, she wasn't like an Asian tiger mom, but still, you know, that kind of way of thinking is prevalent. Mm-hmm. And we're not doing heart surgery. You know, that's serious. You make 1 millimeter wrong, someone could die. You play a C instead of a C sharp, it's not the end of the world. Mm-hmm. And I think something about, you know, we know from historical accounts and also from some old recordings that the way that music was written and performed was an extremely free and creative process. In the Baroque era, you could almost say that 50% was notated and the other 50% was left to the performer to deliver. And that's why there's so few dynamics and instructions in that music, because there was improvisation. And even all these great guys like Mozart, Beethoven, Chopin, etc., we know that they improvise. We know that from one day to the next, from 1 minute to the next, it would be a completely different piece. Mm. And what we're left over with is some kind of document of what was left by, in that short amount of time, by either Mozart or one of his copyists. Mm. And we're lucky if we have a second version or another sketch, right? And but there have been so many professors like, oh, aber das ist Urtext, und Beethoven hat das genau so geschrieben. This is the way it has to be. There are books about this. Yeah, but, you know, there's 5,000 ways to say to be or not to be. That is the question, right? Mm-hmm. And every time you hear ba 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 ba, it should sound like it's the first time it's being played. And many of us have just lost this. And also the problem with classical music is that because it's notated and because you have these exact equal bars with these prison bar lines and the way it's taught, of course. I mean, most teachers go, yeah, but look, he says here, piano. Yeah, how much piano? In relativity to what? You know, we know that, I think, was it Beethoven that said that the metronome mark is only for the first bar?
Really?
I think so.
I mean, Beethoven was the first to use a metronome anyway.
That's true. And we take that way too seriously also. There's a wonderful story I love with Brahms and Joachim playing the violin concerto. And for those who know, Joachim had a lot of say in how it should be and working a lot with him. And they rehearsed it or played it once, and Joachim wasn't happy. He felt it was a bit too fast and not really comfortable. The next day, they rehearsed or played it again, and he went up to Brahms and said, you know, I have to tell you that for me, today was made more sense. It was much slower, and, you know, there was time, and this seems more convincing. And Brahms said, well, look, feel my pulse. It's a lot slower today. And what bothers me is that we as interpretive classical musicians don't take this information that's there, these old recordings that we have of Bartok, Rachmaninoff, Hoffmann, Britten, etc. And these documents that we have, students of Chopin, students of Liszt, how, you know, Czerny, and critically think and go, maybe it's could be like this, instead of, oh, there's a reference recording from Richter in 1961, and that's it. I mean, why? So, yeah, I think one of the problems is the way that it's understood, the way it's taught, and I think recordings didn't help either. And then competitions don't help either, because music is not a sport. And I understand how competitions are maybe a necessary evil, and how it can help people launch to be seen, etc. But, you know, it's the focus is on the wrong things.
Mm. You've worked with some of the greatest musicians of our time. Conductors, orchestras, actors. I don't know whom you don't know, who you haven't worked with. Can you share one collaboration that left a lasting impact on you? Is there something very close to your heart?
Wow. Just to pick one. To pick one is very difficult.
Pick three.
Wow. Well, obviously, I have to say Yehudi Menuhin. Mm-hmm. Not only because I spent 7 years at his school, which, of course, changed my life, but a few years after I left school, on his 80th birthday concert at the Barbican Hall, he chose me to be his soloist. And so my debut, first time I really played with orchestra and first time I played such a big scenario, was playing Beethoven 4th Piano Concerto with him conducting.
Nonetheless.
And Warsaw Symphonia. Yeah, you know, actually, when they asked me, they said, Yehudi would like to play Beethoven 4 with you. Are you free? Are you interested? And I said, please let me think about it. Obviously, I was free. Obviously, I was interested.
But very nice.
I had nothing going on.
Not to answer straight away.
Well, it wasn't trying to be smart. It was just the Beethoven 4 thing.
Oh, yeah.
And then I thought about it and I came back to his secretary and I said, or whoever it was, and I said, you know, I really would love to play this concert. Obviously, it's a great honor, but I'd be happy to do any other concerto but Beethoven 4. 1, 2, 3, 5. I said, I'm even happy to do the violin concerto in the piano arrangement version.
But not this.
But please not 4. And I remember she's saying, it's 4 or nothing. So what is it? And I was like, okay. I mean, I was 23 years old. I had also gone through a difficult time in my life because I had lost my mother at the age of 19. Mm. And at the time I was studying in New York, Manhattan School of Music with Nina Svetlanova. And it happened really in the middle of my studies. And yeah, I mean, losing my mother just completely, I had no gravity. It just completely left me, yeah, not knowing what to do, where to go. And so I spent a lot of years in limbo. Actually, that's the first time I came to Vienna. I came to Vienna shortly after that because I haven't had two wonderful friends back then. One is Alexei, who you mentioned. Another is the violinist, Julian Rachlin. And they were both so sweet. They said, hey, man, you're struggling over there in New York. You know, why don't you come to Vienna? We'll take care of you. You can take time to grieve, to understand what happened with your mother and so on. And when I came here, I spent 2 years in Vienna. They were the worst and the best years of my life. Worst for obvious reasons, but best because here I had time to, enjoy life in a way or discover life. Because I think, of course, obviously I would wish that my mother was still alive today. This goes without saying. But somehow this having happened forced me, catapulted me into this place where I had to like explore other ideas, because otherwise I would have just stayed in this prison of like, okay, I finished my studies, I tried to audition for Leeds or Van Cliven, and I hope I win, and the usual kind of road that you think is the one laid out for a concert pianist. And being here, it allowed me to fall in love with a woman who is now actually my wife. But that's another story. It didn't happen as romantically.
We're on Valentine's Day.
We are
today.
Valentine's Day, but yes. But it gave me a chance to fall in love, which, you know, very often, if you're a pianist, you have no time for. Because as you know, we spend 25 hours a day in a practice room with no windows. So no time for love. I also got to meet some of the most important people friendship-wise, but also that would later be a significant part in either my artistic development or my career. I met Billy Joel, and I guess he would be maybe the second person that I would have to mention, because, I mean, that was my first recording on such a big scale.
Mm-hmm.
And he's such a major superstar, of course, and so that brought me attention in a completely different way.
Mm-hmm.
So I've definitely had an unusual career path.
I think you're so open to all this, unlike typical classical musicians. You know, you have your little energies in spread all over, so that you attract all these collaborations. You attracted people like this because that's not the usual path, as you say. You went completely out of the box.
Well, a lot of composers and musicians before me also did, you know, many different things. It's just we don't know about it so much. If you look at someone like Hindemith, we think of Hindemith as, I mean, I'm just bringing him in as an example, but Hindemith we think of as like this untouchable 20th century composer whose music is quite difficult to understand. You know, he wrote books on theory and rhythm training, and but actually he was an extremely funny guy. And he wrote a lot of funny pieces, did a lot of theater plays involving musicians and this and that. It's a whole side that's not known. And but I was always interested in, for me, I mean, you could spend a whole lifetime just on Beethoven, Opus 110, or Corso Fuga, or whatever. Yes, so that's never ending. On the other hand, life is not just about Beethoven, Corso Fuga, or Missa Solemnis. There's so much other stuff. All this stuff which inspired Beethoven to write this, for starters. You know, there's so much literature, so much art, movies, books, people. People are so fascinating. And I think that's one of the misconceptions of this classical industry / establishment / educational world, is that musicians are not encouraged to go outside of the practice room.
That's a big issue.
Yeah.
Musicians are not encouraged to see, even in the past, what has happened at the same time when Beethoven was composing the Große Fuge, or whatever, what else happened in the world, what else happened in history, in arts, in this great accolades, like life. This, for me, is a big missing point.
Yes. And so I think that's why also classical music is sometimes, I bet you anything, if, you know, one of these guys like Beethoven or Haydn was suddenly transported today, alive, traveling in time, and they listen to all the stuff that's going on. Yeah, I'm sure they won't like everything, but they would be like, whoa, maybe I'll take a bit of reggae and I'll take a bit of, you know, techno and see how, you know, because they were open-minded, creative people. And we somehow lost that a little bit. It feels that way. So, yeah, I was always interested in different art forms. What I didn't like about classical musicians also was that they were so discriminatory of any other music form.
Mm-hmm. Very true. Mm-hmm.
There's so much wonderful pop music. I mean, anything, any music is legitimate. It should not be looked down upon. Who do we think we are with classical
musicians?
That's
also, I think, it's a mentality of, you know, not being taken serious if you think of another kind of music, which society doesn't allow or doesn't seem to have the same level of professionalism.
Yes.
It's frowned upon.
Yes.
What do you think are some of the biggest challenges in keeping classical music alive now after so many years and so many experiences? And how can we engage new audiences?
Well, that's the million-dollar question, which actually we should all be asking. I think I compare the world of classical music to the dinosaur era. And dinosaurs became extinct. So,
That's not very positive.
Well, the one thing that's worse than dinosaurs is being a fossil. But we're very close for classical music to end up in a natural history museum. And I think all these intendants and artistic directors and promoters and important, influential people who make the decisions, you know, a lot of the people now in marketing and finance, they're the ones that decide who plays where and with whom.
Good point, so, yeah.
So fine, I understand there's an economical necessity for tickets to be sold in order to pay for the heating and, you know, the running of the concert hall. I get all of that. And you guys don't even have to like music. I'm even accepting this. But then be good business people. Just do your maths, do your algorithms. So how can one change that? So just be asking yourselves that question, but they're not. Everybody's so comfortable just to stay the same. And when COVID lockdowns happened, I was I was just so hoping and thinking, yes, this is the moment. Not only that the human race, I mean, forget about classical music, that the human race will clunk their heads together and think, how can we refresh this whole thing so that, you know, we can grow many, many steps. But even in this small, tiny ecosystem of classical music, this was the moment where I thought, okay, now...
Restart.
Now it's going to be an incredible restart. People are going to be invigorated, thinking of new ways. This is a wonderful moment. And instead, no, let's just make videos of people in masks and for free.
Exactly.
Content for free because, oh no, don't forget about me, don't forget about me.
Yeah, well,
and let's do it exactly the same. And then once we were out of the COVID lockdowns, let's do concerts in exactly the same way that they were done before.
Mm-hmm.
Now, some of these were noble intents, I know. I don't want to be just dismissive and negative about everything. There were many institutions that did these videos because they were paying their musicians. It was the only way that they could pay their musicians. So I'm thankful for them. But it's just the whole concept. There was not this, you know, we didn't think collectively and feel that this was a moment where we could change it all. And fine, people go into emergency mode during such a situation, no problem. But it's afterwards, it's now 2025. It's now 2025. It's 5 years since the COVID lockdown. We're back. And actually, it's worse than back.
Yeah.
It's worse than back. So again, to all the presenters and promoters and programmers and et cetera, all those people out there, it's like, okay, you don't have to love music the same way that I do. But think about ways that you can, you know, any brand, anything, Coca-Cola, Mercedes, you name it. They're having meetings, I don't know, every week or every month. Gucci famously got like 20 or 40 kids from universities who had no experience of marketing or, you know, they were still early in this, got them in the room and said, okay, how can we, what do you guys want? You're in touch with the young generation. How should we be designing? How should we be marketing? And their sales roared. They went so high, that's what these people should be doing. But it's not happening. So I have many ideas how we could change this. But I'm not sure that people are listening. I don't know if people would care what I have to say. And I'm not in it to be rebellious or to, you know, It's just like I said at the beginning, I love classical music so much that I want it to be shared in an accessible way with as many, many people as possible, in an authentic way.
Mm.
And, you know, true beauty, I mean, human beauty doesn't need makeup to be beautiful. If you are a beautiful person inside and you think beautiful things and you feel beautiful things, you are a beautiful person. So you don't need all the makeup and the right lighting and the photoshopping. Yes. So it's the same. If we can, we don't need, it's not like you have to have, huge light shows and dances or whatever to make classical music attractive.
Mm-hmm.
You could also just come on and, but it's the whole attitude.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, it's the difference between, and if you served real quality, then I think people feel the quality. I think at the end of the day, quality wins, even if you're not a connoisseur of classical music.
Mm-hmm.
Even if you're not a connoisseur of food or cars or whatever, you feel quality. And when you feel that somehow you're not getting that quality or that authenticity, you feel a bit robbed.
Mm.
You might not be able to put your finger on it, but that's when you walk out dissatisfied.
Yeah. Are you teaching? Are you a teacher as well?
I love teaching.
Because I think you'd be a great teacher.
Oh, thank you so much. Yes, I love to teach. I'm hoping to collaborate with an institution that would be similar-minded.
Mm-hmm.
I've had one or two propositions, but for various reasons, I had to decline, either because it's, it's very far away or doesn't work with the schedule. But, at the end of 2025, my activities as a duo, Igorzmana Duo, we're retiring as a performing duo. And so there will be more time for me to teach. But I've always tried to, I still have students who, come to me. Recently, I was on the jury of the Cleveland International Piano Competition. And they have this mentoring award scheme, mm-hmm. whatever. So I'm in touch with two of the participants
mm-hmm.
from the Cleveland Piano Competition. And, occasionally speaking with them and advising them on whatever they want to ask.
That's also something missing.
Yes.
This is lacking in this industry. Unless you know somebody who knows somebody and by chance you come to somebody and, you try your luck, there is no scheme for mentoring.
Yes. There's no care package.
Yeah.
I've always said that institutions or teachers or whatever, the education system, the ecosystem of classical music doesn't give tools to musicians if they are successful and if they are not successful.
Mm-hmm.
And we need both.
We should open a school.
I would love that. I've always dreamt of, my wife and I have dreamt of this, to create some kind of academy and institution that would cater for every individual's needs.
So if there are any sponsor listenings,
yes.
Do get in contact.
If there's some oil tycoon that needs to like
some... No, we're very green.
Okay. So if there's some very wealthy trillionaire that wants to have tax write-offs, we don't care if you like Beethoven or not. Just give us money and we'll change the world.
But talking about mentoring and mentors, I think now is the time to talk about our common friend, and more than that, Mihailo Sulesa.
I'm going to pour some tea for this. Yes.
So Mihaela Ursulasa was a Romanian concert pianist known for her extraordinary talent, technical brilliance, and expressive depth. She gained international recognition at a young age. She was really a prodigy back in Romania, winning the prestigious Clara Haskell competition in 1995. She studied at the Vienna University, and funnily enough, her recording, her CD, the title was Piano and Forte, which, is very much in line with my podcast name. And tragically, she passed away unexpectedly in 2012 at the age of 33. She left a lasting impact on the classical music, and she touched a lot of lives.
Yes, she did. She touched certainly all the people that came into any contact with her, since her death, I've met many people who were just who were the porter of the concert hall, or you know, someone who was working at the coat stand or something. They just literally just brushed, crossed paths for a few seconds, but those people have a lasting impression. So for those of us who are incredibly lucky to have her in our close circle of lives, we were incredibly impactful, incredibly touched by her. She was someone that was so open as a person, this spirit of generosity. I've come across it. I've met a lot of people, and I'm very lucky. I've met a lot of really wonderful people. Okay, I never met the Dalai Lama, but Michaela is on that level of just generosity of spirit, and she, and I guess if I'm speaking personally, I've never felt, even until now, and while I have, you know, very strong and close relationships, that somebody understood me as well as she did. We laughed at the same things that nobody could understand why we're laughing at them. And I'm surrounded by quite a lot of funny people, and I have a very open sense of humor. But sometimes we were the only two people laughing in the room, because we would see some detail about whatever that just didn't make any sense at all. And so for me personally, that's a connection that's, unique. And
How did you meet each other?
How did we meet? You know, I actually met her when she was maybe 15 or 16 years old. No, maybe younger. Maybe 13 or 14. It was at a party of a friend of mine called Ophelia Olandiani. Mm. And even back then, Ophelia loved putting on parties with musicians. Mm-hmm. She's, if there's any other trillionaires, please give her lots of money, because she will also create such beautiful house salon concerts. I mean, this is her passion. If there was a job which is to make house salon evenings, she would be the best. That's her real passion. And she was doing it already back then, when we were all young and students. Creating parties, of course, with, you know, wine and food, but getting all kinds of people there and getting artists and musicians. And so it was really just a big jam of everything. And at that moment, there, on one of the nights, if not two of the nights, there was this young Romanian whiz kid of a pianist who just ran up on and started playing whatever, Scriabin and Brahms, and just, and, you know, I went to the Humanities School, so I was always surrounded by whiz kids, but she had something special, something that stood out. And I was like, wow, who is this? And then I didn't see her for maybe another, I don't know, at least 10 years, 10, 12 years, when I came to move here. Maybe it was a bit longer. And I can't remember how we met, like, properly. Maybe it was a place called Broadway Bar. Could be. I don't know. We had mutual friends. Maybe it was through, doesn't matter, but we met. And we hit it off right away. I think one of our very first evenings that we met, we actually walked, for hours through the city of Vienna, and just talking. Mm. And we ended up having hot chocolate somewhere at 3 a.m. And she was so helpful to me as well, because she was already quite well established. I was a newcomer to Vienna. She's several years younger than me, but she was very helpful to me. One of the times I was asked by Christian Jevi, the conductor, he called me and he said, listen, someone has canceled, can you jump in with Shostakovich's second concerto?
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, I didn't play that piece, and I didn't have time to learn it. I said, oh, Christian, I'm afraid I can't make it. He said, oh, that's a shame. Is there any other pianist you could recommend for me?
Mm-hmm.
I said, there's only one I can think of, Mikhail Osiliazov. He said, oh, yeah. So anyway. So Michaela told me later that...
she hadn't played it either.
No, I can't remember if she played it or not, but he called her.
Okay.
And she couldn't do it. And he asked her, oh, it's a shame you can't do it. Who would you recommend? And she said, there's only one guy I would recommend. It's Yankee Joe.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was a real support and love and respect.
Which is very unusual between pianists, we have to say this as well. This is another topic.
That's very true. We know how much animosity and jealousy and lack of support there is in this classical music business. Yes.
Yeah, that's why this podcast was born, to try to change this a bit.
Yes.
But I'll tell you my story with Mihaila.
Please.
Because Mihaila, I met her once in my entire life.
Wow.
And she changed my life completely.
Wow.
So she came back to Romania after winning the Clara Haskell competition.
Yeah.
And after, you know, she came to Vienna because Claudia Abbado brought her to Vienna. And he insisted she should have a music education at the Music University in Vienna.
Yes.
And did everything for her. So Mihaila came back to Bucharest. I think it was the first time playing back home. And she was one of the first to play both piano concertos by Chopin in one evening. This was a highlight. And the radio hall was packed. The energy was just, you know, you could feel the tension. She gave that concert. It was amazing. And the next day, by pure chance, somebody organized for me to play for her. But there was no reasoning for that. I mean, we were not expecting anything. Just like that. And we went to the hall. It was in complete darkness. And I remember Mihaila shouting at somebody, but in a kind way, asking for some lights. And we just got one very diffuse light. And she said, well, you'll have to play like that now. So, yeah, just play whatever you want. So I played for half an hour. And she said, do you have an etude? Do you have a Bach? Do you have a sonata or something? And you know, I was back then 15.
Okay.
And after that half an hour, I said, listen, you have to try the entrance exam at the Music University. I'll send you all the papers. You have to come.
Wow.
And she did that. She did send the papers at that time in 2000, you know, Google and the internet was not so...
Yes.
Yeah, not like now. And she sent me the papers through another pianist.
Wow.
And I applied. I think I met her in January. The deadline was March.
Yes.
In June, I did the exam.
Yes.
I passed. And I called her.
Wow.
You know, I thanked her because she literally changed my life through this half an hour meeting.
Yeah.
And I told her who my teacher will be and that I will start in October. Yeah. And, you know, I was still in high school and so on. And that was the last time we spoke. We never met each other again. I tried to go to her concerts, but it didn't work out.
Yeah.
I never had the chance to see her in person. It's crazy. One meeting can change your life, but that shows
very true
how generous she was and how in the moment she was. And we met each other, you and me, a couple of years ago, before the pandemic, when you asked me to come to Patricia Kopaczynska's home to talk about Mihaila, where her daughter was there.
That's right.
Who was... at that time, 16, as I was when I came to Vienna. And I mean, that's how crazy life is.
Yes, I remember you mentioning that you were very touched by Mihaila and that you felt like you never had the chance to thank her. Mm-hmm. And as you know, my wife and I were godparents to Stefania, Steffi, Usleaza, and she lost her mother when she was six. So she's been brought up by her grandmother. They stayed in Vienna. And my wife and I took the responsibility of godparents, although we're not religious in any way, but we took that responsibility very seriously. And I don't think I even had the moment to grieve about Michaela, because as soon as I heard the news,
imagine.
As soon as I heard the news, of course I was shocked. But the next second, I was like, okay, we have to take care of Steffi. So there was no real moment to kind of brood about the past. It was like, I got to be now present for the present and the future. So, and actually, of course I've shed tears several times, but the symbolic moment came for me finally a few months ago when I was in Bucharest playing at that radio hall a week before you.
Yes.
We both played in that hall a week apart. And of course, the first thing that I wanted to do was to go see her grave. And I asked Steffi, who's now 18, if she would go with me. And so, which she did. So we went together, and she took me to her mother's grave. And that was the first time, really, I was sort of confronted with, okay, here she, this is what happened. Yeah, for me, it was always about, okay, I now have to take care of Steffi. And she, you know, like I said, she was brought up by her grandmother, but who's amazing that she, I mean, she's so much older and had a lot of difficulties, but she pulled through. And but my wife and I were always on standby. When we moved to our new place, we had a room. It's a small room, but we always said, if Steffi needs to come here, this is her room. And she has the keys to our place. And we, you know, she's very often in our place. And we always tell her, listen, you come anytime. You don't have to say hi. You just come in the fridge, take what you want, go. And she has just developed into, she's become such a beautiful, positive person. I mean, you met her briefly.
Exactly. I couldn't. I mean, I'm...
Right?
I cannot put into words. I mean, we both have children.
Yes.
You have two children, I have two children. It's so unbearable to think what she must have been through. I mean, this is just not...
Right. Conceivable.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes.
And to see her so positive and so just beautiful in and out, it still moves me to tears.
It's very much her mother's spirit, I have to say. Sometimes she laughs exactly the same. And actually, to be honest, Steffi and I, we have also that similar connection that we laugh at very silly, nonsensical, illogical things. And, you know, we don't make a big deal out of it, but very often we're like, oh my God, that's exactly how Michaela laughed. And, you know, that's, which I think she appreciates.
I think it's so important for her as well to know that you have known her and you've been so close to her and that you are still part of Steffi's life and are the connection through both of them.
She has dreams and aspirations to sing.
Really?
And she's been taking voice lessons. And the other day, I think she's going to do some auditions. So, I mean, of course, the worst people for her to play with is, of course, me. And you know, in front of my family. But it's like, come on, Steffi, you got to do this. This is the most difficult, playing with me and, you know, in front of people that you know. But she has something special to offer. Let's see what happens.
Do you think the legacy of Mihaela is being properly recognized today? And is there something we can do? I remember we spoke a few years ago about planning to do something.
Yes.
How can I?
Yes, I'm.
Help, or what
well,
can we do?
The answer to that is no. I don't think her legacy is being remembered enough. In full objective analysis, I think most people's legacy is not remembered enough. In this, certainly in this classical music world. But you know, the world is moving so fast. You know, we're here to talk. I mean, years ago, there was the most famous footballer and the most famous sports person was a guy called Ronaldo. He won the World Cup. He was Brazilian. And there was only one Ronaldo. And then came along this other guy, this Portuguese young guy called Cristiano Ronaldo. Because there was already this other Ronaldo, he couldn't be called Ronaldo. It was always Cristiano Ronaldo. Now, if you ask people, who is Ronaldo? Nobody knows that Brazilian guy who won the World Cup and who was the most. There's only this one. And that's how quickly people forget. I have a friend who teaches at NYU piano and piano literature and whatever. And she was, you know, playing recordings of Horowitz and Josef Hoffmann and you name it, Rubinstein. The kids have no idea who these people are. It seems inconceivable to me, because now in our generation, you're a lot younger than me, but you know what I mean. If we wanted to listen to something, we had to go to libraries or borrow people's recordings or steal stuff. You know? And now they have it all. They have Spotify, YouTube. I mean, at a snap of a finger, they can have almost any historical recording, even live concerts. You think about all these live streaming platforms. How can you not know who these people are? So, of course, it's no surprise in the way that someone like Mihaela Uslyaz is also not so remembered. But yes, I would love to create some way to honor her. And again, if there's another trillionaire.
So we need sponsors
and we need
promoters
and
one wonderful concert hall.
Yes.
To do this.
Yes.
I don't think this is impossible.
You know, in life, it's so much about one person.
Yeah.
Who is that person? For you, it was Mihaela, and I'm sure many other people. But there aren't many people. And it's really about who is your dentist, who's your hairdresser, you know, who's the person that cooks for you on that day, even if you go to, you know what I mean? So it's all about people. And if we have the right people who are in positions of influence, in positions of affluence, then the world would move forward. But if there are only people sitting in those positions who are full of their own ego, who are only full of their own ego and their own interests and not thinking about how the next generation or even the one after, you know, to lay it out for them, then the world will not really move forward.
Well, let's do this. We're two already who would love to do this. So
I would love to.
This is a promise for the future.
Yes, you're on. With great pleasure.
What keeps you motivated after so many years in this crazy industry?
My love for music. Very simple. Sounds kitsch and cliche, but that's the reason why I got into it. That's the reason why I've struggled and suffered and still ready to do it. I mean, I hope for an easier path. You know how difficult it is yourself. I mean, someone of your playing talent should not have time to do this podcast with me.
Oh, you know? That's my pleasure.
Yeah, I mean, I'm still amazed. I'm actually envious and amazed that you learned that concerto. Was it Katz German?
Chernin, right? Yes.
Katz Chernin piece in like 4 days or something?
Yeah.
That's horrible. How can you do that? No. I hate people like
you. Well, you know, adrenaline is a good medicine.
It's amazing. I mean, you played with what? London Philharmonic and Yurovsky, piece that you never played before.
Yeah, but you know, if Vladimir says, could you come?
That's insane.
You cannot say no.
No, that's insane. So, I mean, that's incredibly respectful. I think I don't know if I could do that. But it's my love for music. An interviewer asked me recently, yes, if you're playing a recital but nobody's heard of you, no one will come. And I said, well, okay, if that's the case, I'll play on the streets.
Mm.
There are so many ways that a musician can be impactful. That's another thing. I think the ecosystem and the educational system only targets, really leads you for one kind of life, which is to be this shining, dazzling, famous soloist that plays 100 times Tchaikovsky 1 around the world. That's not realistic. That will be maybe afforded to 5, 10, 15, 20 people.
Times have changed. And it's not the reality anymore.
It's not reality. Yeah. And you should think about what other things you can do. But actually, you know, even if you're playing in Carnegie Hall 100 times a year, it will never, ever match the feeling of playing for 100 elderly people or 100 handicapped children or 100 refugees from wherever.
Mm-hmm.
It absolutely impossible. There, people will be crying, laughing, dancing. Their whole existence, their molecular being will be transformed by your music. That will not happen at Carnegie Hall. And I wish there was a way for musicians to have access to this kind of performance. And then they would realize, I just had a wonderful lunch the other day with an old friend of mine who, you know, worked with Harnoncourt for many years and is now doing leadership workshops where he's going to, you know, working with CEOs of companies and through music, showing how you can be a better leader. And that's another way that music is impactful.
Very interesting, yeah. How do you deal with doubt?
Oh, it's an interesting question you ask, because just yesterday I watched something, an interview with Claudio Rao, or someone talking about Claudio Rao, that they asked him, do you still, late in his life, are you still fearful when you go on stage? And he said, yes, of course. I have so much fear, but I've learned to use that fear, to take advantage of that fear, to channel that fear. And I do believe that I think fear is not a good thing to have. It's not a good word. It's not a good emotion. It's human, yes. But I've never really understood these musicians who are in their 60s and 70s and hugely successful, but still have to be pushed on stage or throw up 3 times before they go on stage.
We know a few.
We know a few, yes. Now, I have a very good friend who is constantly throwing up before he goes on, and he's incredible. That's never really happened to me. But, I mean, I played a few weeks ago with Deutsche Kammerphilharmonie in Bremen, Rachmaninoff 2. And,
you know. No stomach pain? No.
Before, during, and after. For days. And there were 2 performances. So the second day I was still recovering from the first one. So it's a kind of masochistic experience as well. But if you can find a way to channel, well, doubt is the worst thing to think about. It's exactly at the moments when you're in doubt that things go wrong. You have to trust. You just have to trust. That's the Greek myth, isn't it? Like when the hero, you even see that in Star Wars, when Luke Skywalker is confronted with Darth Vader and he just, instead of joining him, he decides to just fall. Theoretically to his death. He has no idea. That's a mythological, that's all symbolic. It's like falling into an abyss, a bottomless pit where you don't know where you will fall.
This our stage?
Yeah, I guess so. But you have to throw yourself there. But at least in the hero myth, they come out heroes. You come out triumphant because you have taken that, it's called in English, leap of faith.
Yeah.
Right? So I have no magic answers or magic words. Of course, one of the things I do in my workshops, I have a workshop called Beyond the Practice Room. You asking me earlier if I love teaching. That's something I love doing with students because as we've been talking, there are so many things in our education and profession that are never talked about. We're never told about stage presence, body posture, stretching, health, nutrition, mindfulness,
mindset,
how to prepare, how to talk, etiquette, social etiquette, elocution, improvisation, physical freedom.
So that's the new curriculum of our school. So come on, we have to do it.
Audition process, how to speak to agents, etc., etc., etc. There's so many facets that are just not talked about. And the pianists are some of the worst people. Pianists have no social skills whatsoever. And those that do, it's better they don't speak. So,
so funny. But why is this, do you think, because they are spending all their life at the instrument or they're locked in one room, they're locking themselves in one room and then they're missing out life? Or, I mean, what's the reason?
I think that's part of it. I think it's all of the above and more. I know plenty of pianists and piano teachers who discourage themselves or their students from playing chamber music. And not just pianists, I know also string players too, where, you know, these famous professors say, "What? You played string quartet yesterday? What? What a waste of time. You should be practicing your Paganini. There's the Queen Elizabeth competition next week. What are you doing?" I mean, this is the mentality we live in. This is a dinosaur. It's going to be very hard to move this dinosaur, but we have to start moving it. Because if a pianist sticks, and you know, that was very interesting because at the Cleveland piano competition where I was jury last summer, one of the rounds was chamber music.
Of course.
And I can't remember how many semifinalists there were. Was it eight? Eight of them? So now they were in a round. We had heard them, these eight people. And obviously we put them through because they were all incredible, wonderful virtuosos and wonderful musicians playing their Chopin and Debussy, whatever. But now they had to play Beethoven and Brahms piano trios.
Yeah.
There were two other musicians on stage. How did they communicate? How did they play? How did they nuance? How did they balance? You know, what did they bring out? How did they incorporate?
How did they adapt? Yeah.
And a lot of them lost our belief trust in them, our trust, due to the way they play chamber music. So I don't know who's listening to this, but if you want to do well, at least with the seven of us who are jury members, you better start playing chamber music. That's just what it is.
And go to concerts, and go to exhibitions, and go absolutely to theater, and
yes,
live life.
Live life. Yes, really live life. You know, one of my favorite quotes I came across quite recently is, ships are safest when they're docked at the harbor, but that's not what they were built for. I absolutely love this because we often think we need to be in this safe, cozy place. But if you're a ship, you're built to explore the earth. And yes, you will come across storms and whales and whatever. But that's what you were built for. There's that famous joke of the guy who, you know, is praying to God every day, you know, to win the lottery. And he's so religious and so devout and so loyal. And, you know, he's about in his last years and he's like, God, you know, I've done everything for you. I've been such a wonderful person. Why didn't you just let me win the lottery? And God speaks and says, well, you could go and buy a lottery ticket.
Yeah.
So we need to take that adventure a step. And yes, bad things could happen. Yeah, of course. If you cross the road, yeah, you can get hit by a car. But if you don't cross the road, you won't see what the other side looks like.
This brings me to my last question.
Yes. I've talked way too much. I know. You have to cut a lot.
It's been wonderful. If you could go back and give advice to your younger self, what would it be?
To have taken more note and appreciation of where I was and who I was with. Not from a archival documental purpose, but when you're younger, when you're, you know, youthful, you think that you're going to live forever. And as we know, that's not always the case, as we spoke about Michaela. And before you know it, some of the most incredible moments in your life happened without you realizing it was. Wasn't it John Lennon who said, life is what's happening while you're busy making other plans? And so we're always, so many of us are just focused on the next move rather than just, and I've had a very wonderful life. And if this is my last podcast, okay, it'll be a bit sad. Because, you know,
you better watch out how you cross the road.
Yeah. I'd like to be around a bit longer.
Please.
But if this was my last moment, I leave with very few regrets and very, very fortunate, very lucky to have met so many wonderful people and lived so many different kinds of lives. You know, I've stayed in castles and I've stayed on wooden floors and with no heating and I've had friendships with people on the streets and also whatever. And I've fallen in love. I've had my heart broken. You know, some people have never had their heart broken. And I think I'm very lucky to have experienced all this crap and beauty. And but yes, even that being said, I wish that there were times when I just stood longer and said, "What?" and take it all in, rather than think about, let's, you know, this is Tuesday, let's think about Wednesday. And I would also tell my younger self to practice more and at the same time practice less. Practice more at the right times and practice less at the right times. I think maybe that would have helped me a lot more.
Thank you so much for this meaningful conversation.
Ah, thank you.
What a joy it was to speak with Yanky Ju, an artist who reminds us that music doesn't have to stay inside the lines to be meaningful. His creativity, humor, and humanity are truly inspiring, and I hope you felt that as much as I did. Thank you so much for listening. It feels so good to be back. If you enjoyed this episode, don't forget to follow the Pianofortissimo podcast on Instagram or Alexandra Silocha, leave a review and share it with a friend or fellow musician who might need a little spark of inspiration today. More exciting conversations are on the way, so stay tuned. And until next time, take care, stay curious, and oh, how I miss to say this, worry less and let the music flow.